From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our callers, some topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about aspirin, the FDA, preventing heart attacks, and the firestorm it is created by discussing whether or not it prevents the first heart attack.
And what else?
Cholesterol-lowering drugs and stroke. New information about how these drugs may help reduce our risk of stroke.
And great a yummy stuff. Recipe?
Potato pizza. Now, you might not think of potatoes and pizza together. I know that's not what you do, Tom. Mm-hmm. I know that you like feet pizza, but it is a fabulous, fabulous recipe that is actually delicious.
That's right. I remember this recipe from the vault. I didn't like the idea of it, and I actually have never tasted it.
Well, that's not unusual. I don't think you taste most of the recipes you make. I know you're shocked, but actually, potato pizza is something that people like. They ask about. They sometimes go to our wonderful website. So I think anyone who has not heard this recipe, listen up and get your pen.
800-462-7413, the number to call. And now to the phones we go, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I have a question about, I went to my dental hygienist for some teeth cleaning, and she recommended x-rays, and I said, well, I had several x-rays already taken this year. I'm not really interested in having any more x-rays. And she said, oh, they're digital. I said, well, x-rays are x-rays, aren't they? And she said, oh, no, digital x-rays are different.
Uh-huh.
Now, I didn't buy that, and I said, no, I'm not going to have x-rays this time. I just don't. I think I've had, I've been x-rayed twice this year already, so I said, I'm going to pass on that.
Well, she is wrong, by the way. Digital x-ray, an x-ray is an x-ray is an x-ray. I don't remember what poet said that, but that's basically what it is. And instead of using film, you know, instead of using Kodak x-ray film, where they made a ton of money for years using film, it just uses a digital technology to record it on a plate. But it's basically, the only thing that's different is basically how it's recorded. It's not anything else. So you write about x-rays. So tell me, you've had other x-rays?
I injured my hand, and I had my hand x-rayed about 14 times.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's
in different positions and stuff. And then I had a bout with sciatica, and they wanted to make sure that it wasn't the fact that I have a pin in my leg. They wanted to make sure that the pin hadn't moved. So I had my lower body x-rayed several times.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought I had plenty of x-rays for this year.
Right. Well, those x-rays have more radiation, obviously, than dental x-rays. You know, it's kind of interesting. Tom, do you get x-rays when you go to the dentist?
Well, I get them every couple of years, but they try to talk you into doing them more often.
Every year, yeah. And you know what I do? I do the same thing. They put those gum things into your mouth. You have to open up your mouth. It's kind of, I don't like the way those things
kind of
feel. Well,
they put that big, heavy thing.
Big, heavy apron,
you
know, and they go through all this stuff and do the x-ray. But I do the same thing. They'll say, we want to do an x-ray. And I'll say, well, you know, I had one a few years ago. When we look from a radiation safety point of view, it's a very, very small amount of radiation. On the other hand, radiation is radiation is radiation.
Yeah.
And the real issue when we look at x-rays is youth. So if you take x-rays of a child, we'll say, or a young adult who's 20 years old, the chances that x-ray will cause a problem actually 40 years later are there. It's a small number. It's not a big number, but it's a small number. You take too many x-rays on a number of people and you're going to cause cancer somewhere. That's the issue. If you take an x-ray when you're 60 or 70 years old, it doesn't have as long a chance to make it. So youth is really the big issue. What did your hygienist said the x-ray didn't count because it was digital?
She said that they were different because they were digital.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, I'm not buying that. I said, I don't think so.
Yeah, well, they're different in terms of how they're developed, but they're not different in terms of the x-ray. So well, do you think she'll still clean your teeth next year?
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
So we're going to relabel the name of the show, Truth or Consequences.
How many of you out there remember that?
I know, that's what I was just thinking. Truth or Consequences, I think it was Bob Barker, and it was a show. It was in the 50s and the 60s. Well, what were the consequences?
It's a city in New Mexico.
Truth or Consequences, yeah. I don't think the show took place. I think it took place from Hollywood, though.
Yeah, right. They had some contest, and New Mexico won, and they – anyway, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number.
It's the Geography Show with Tom Clark. Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
And a listener joins in now in Hayden, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Hey, here's the deal. I am a really good sleeper at night. I go to sleep quickly, and when I wake up during the night, I go back to sleep very quickly also. But when I wake up in the morning, I sleep about anywhere from 7 to 9 hours a night, generally about 8 on the average, I would say. But when I wake up in the morning and get up, I notice that I'm extremely lethargic, and I don't have any energy. Even when I get some coffee and sit down in my chair, I notice my breathing even is kind of a deep and, you know, slow type of breathing. And I look in the mirror, my eyes, and they seem to look kind of tired and everything. And even after I eat breakfast and take a shower and brush my teeth, I'm still feeling lethargic. And it takes me a long time to really get firing on all cylinders. And I suspect it's related to, I think I'm a very deep sleeper.
Oh, sure. You might be there. Let me ask a few questions. First of all, medicines. On any pills at all?
You know, I have two medications, yeah. And they're a light dosage. I take 10 milligrams of a statin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in the morning, I have 50 micrograms of thyroxine.
Thyroxine. So that's it. By the way, your thyroid was tested within the last year or so?
It was.
Okay.
And my T4 is very high normal. It's almost high.
That's okay. High normal. High normal is fine. You know,
okay.
It's a range. And docs, you know, regulate it based on something called the TSH.
Yeah.
But okay, so the thyroid is there. Next question. What time do you go to sleep at night?
I'm generally go to bed at 11.
At 11 o'clock. Uh-huh. What time you wake up?
About seven.
Okay, so you're getting a good 8 hours. 8 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
How long does it take you before you sort of wake up in the morning?
You know, it takes me a long time. The only thing I know.
Long time is how much?
4 hours.
4 hours is a long time. You know, I ask that, by the way, because some people will say a long time and they'll say it takes me about a half an hour, and they consider that a long time. I certainly think we all would consider 4 hours to be a long time. A couple more questions. Depression. Have you ever suffered from depression?
No, mm-hmm. And actually I'm a pretty upbeat kind of guy.
Okay. Okay, because
yeah.
Sometimes depression will do it. People will wake up, they'll feel groggy in the morning because they really are suffering from depression, or something else. How long has it been going on?
Gosh, I don't know, maybe 4 years.
4 years, quite a long time.
I'm 72 years of age. I should throw that out there.
Uh huh. Yeah, well, 72 years young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's it. 72 years young.
By the way, I should throw in there real quickly that the thing that really seems to get me out of it is mm-hmm. physical activity.
Sure. Sure, physical activity is good. Usually it gets a lot of people up and going. First of all, I think it's a sleep issue. Like you said, I don't think it's a drug issue. It's not a medication. They wouldn't be doing anything like that. You may be a deep sleeper. You sleep through the night. You get up during the night once or twice at all?
Yeah, I do. I usually have to get up once or twice to mm-hmm. go to the bathroom, uh-huh. but when I go back to bed, I go to sleep right away.
Okay, so you don't stay up during the night. So I just think that you're a deep sleeper. I think that's what happens. Sleep changes as we get older.
Uh-huh.
For some people, they're light sleepers. For other people, they become deeper sleepers. You know, then first thing we do is look at medication issue, too much caffeine, too much alcohol, no exercise, diabetes, all those things. You don't have any of those things. You're just up, and it takes you a while to get going. You know?
Yeah,
and
I'm quite alert. I mean, it happens. I get quite alert during the evening, so that might be related.
Yeah, that might be. One of the things you can do in order to improve this, because that's it, get up, have your cup of coffee, wait a half an hour before you start exercise. Because when you're 72, you often have people have a little arthritis. Their joints aren't working quite as well. And once they move around, they sort of that gelling arthritis seems to disappear. I'd wait a half an hour or an hour, and what I do is I take a walk, get on a bike, and do something in terms of exercise to wake up your body. That's what I would do.
Okay.
I wouldn't take anything to go to sleep, because you go to sleep sleep well, you get up to go to the washroom, and you go right back to sleep. I wouldn't do anything with drugs. I would do it with a natural way of getting your body moving with exercise, and that'll probably wake you up. The other issue is caffeine is the most common stimulant used in the world.
Uh-huh.
When the Dutch introduced caffeine to the New World, they became masters of the universe because they had coffee and the English were having rum for breakfast in the morning.
Uh-huh.
So I would recommend a nice steep cup of coffee in that first 30 minutes. Then I'd hit the bike. That's what I would do. Or
not,
something else.
Not rum?
Not rum.
How about rum and coffee?
There we go. We have the New England and the Dutch all together. So good luck. That's what you need. Exercise is the answer. There's nothing wrong with your body. I wouldn't do any further testing.
Got it.
Take care. Thanks
a lot.
Sure.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
Thanks.
The call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413.
So what do you think would happen to the public radio audience if I would recommend a breakfast drink of rum and coffee in the morning?
Well, I think it may be a little divided. I don't think it would be unanimous one way or the other.
No, I don't think so either.
Talking about aspirin, and I'm glad you are, FDA, kind of a warning not that long ago about taking an aspirin a day, which I always thought was a really good idea.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't really a warning. What happened was there's a whole bunch of information that came out and sort of misinformation that came out concerning aspirin, and here was the issue. The Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, mm-hmm. which, by the way, aspirin is a generic name in America. It mm-hmm. was the trade name from Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, and America took it away from them in World War II because mm-hmm. Bayer is German. So all over the world, acetylsalicylic acid, or ASA, is branded as aspirin except in the United States where it's a generic name. Thought I'd fill you in on a little history.
Yeah.
Okay, this is what we know. We know that after you've had a heart attack, an aspirin actually keeps you from having a second heart attack. There is no disagreement on that. The FDA doesn't disagree with that at all. Doctors don't disagree.
Right.
There's some groups that should not take it. And aspirin, we know, has side effects. It can produce bleeding and stomach ulcers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
If
you fall and you hit your head, if you have aspirin and you're likely to fall, you might have a cranial bleed, and that might be bad for you. So there's some people who should not be on aspirin who have had a heart attack. But the real issue is the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company wanted to put on their label, take an aspirin to prevent the first heart attack from happening.
Right.
And the FDA said, no way. You have not proven that, okay? In other words, you have not proven that taking an aspirin to prevent a heart attack will actually happen in someone who has never had a heart attack.
But I thought that we're supposed to take an aspirin before we've had a heart attack.
There are a number of studies that show that if you're at risk for having a heart attack, such as high cholesterol or diabetes, mm-hmm. you should take an aspirin a day. But the FDA has different rules when they look at these studies. In other words, they've got a bar that may be higher than what we doctors use, and there was no long-term study that the FDA said would be required that showed, I don't want to say beyond a shadow of a doubt because they're not up to that type of evidence, but we don't agree that you can change the label. And that's what's caused all this hullabaloo. A lot of doctors, including myself, still say an aspirin a day after a certain age is very useful. I'm not going to change that because of the FDA, because we use drugs for what are called off-label use,
mm-hmm.
and that's exactly what this is.
Well, I hate this where the bottom line is, ask your doctor.
Yeah, well, I don't,
because one doctor says one thing, another.
Well, but for most doctors, this is not an ask-your-doctor question. In other words, cardiologist, endocrinologist, family doctors, internists agree, for the most part, that taking an aspirin a day will prevent a heart attack for people at risk, such as diabetics and people with high cholesterol, people with high blood pressure and other risks. The real question is, let's say you are a 65-year-old patient who has no high blood pressure, no mm-hmm. risk factors for heart attacks. Should they be on an aspirin? Well, there's kind of a controversy, and that's where you really have to sit down and ask your doctor. But if you've got any risk for cardiovascular disease, I still think an aspirin a day outweighs its benefits, and so do many other docs.
Yeah.
The FDA, God bless them, is just not on the same page.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a question from a listener, Jerry, in Edmond, Oklahoma. Zorba and Tom, this will sound like a truly insignificant medical question, but why do I sneeze in triplets? That is, if I must sneeze, I must sneeze three separate times. I've often tried stopping with two sneezes, and I cannot force a fourth one. Three times always seems to work. Is it a scientific fact or just mere conditioning? I'm 69 years old, and it does seem that I've sneezed in triplets for most of my life.
Yeah, we don't have any idea. I used to sneeze singularly. I now sneeze twice.
Huh.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I looked up, I've gone through the literature to see why do some people sneeze twice. And you know what? That's the whole thing about science. Some things have never been studied.
To me, it's on and off. Sometimes one will do it, sometimes twice.
Oh, no, I
sometimes
do two.
Sometimes three.
I now do two in a row. I like, choo-choo. And then and then there's often like a 30-second pause. It'll be choo-choo. And they're never like choo-choo-choo.
Your so sneeze sounds like choo-choo?
It sounds like a choo-choo train.
I don't think so.
It sounds like a choo-choo train. Choo-choo. Choo-choo. It sounds like a choo-choo.
So we have no answer
you know,
to this.
We have no answer right. to this. Except if I don't get my mind off of this, I'm not going to be able to do the rest of the show because I'm going to be laughing too hard. Are you going to say choo-choo to me every so often?
No, I'll leave it alone. have a question for Zorba.
Choo-choo.
A good doc will send his advice right back at choo. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email too.
Zorba at WPR.org or find us through Facebook. Remember, choo-choo-choo.
Yeah, don't forget. A recipe from the vault is coming up. More of your calls, of course. Some more interesting emails to read at our Medical Myth Buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time now, Zorba. And as you know, from time to time, we like to put the spotlight on a recipe that was a past favorite in a segment we like to call Recipes from the Vault.
Can I go?
No.
I can't do that?
Not every time.
Okay. I'm going to do it. Okay.
Today's vault recipe is a classic. Potato. I get to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I got potato pizza.
You remember potato pizza.
No,
we talked about it. Yeah. And can you guess, Zorba, what year this first aired? I'll give you a few hints.
Okay.
In the year this recipe first aired, the Pittsburgh Steelers beat the Arizona Cardinals in Super Bowl 43. Remember that.
Right. I was going to say.
Slumdog Millionaire won the Oscar for Best Picture and Tiger Woods announced he was leaving professional golf to focus on
his
marriage. No, his marriage.
On his wife.
He should have quit golf for a longer period of time.
He should have focused on his marriage prior to that.
Anyway, think about the year while we do the recipe. Let you guess after we're done, and then I'll tell you whether you're right or not.
So let's go to the recipe. Start out with pizza dough. Mm-hmm. You're going to need some vegetable cooking oil spray.
Okay.
I tend to use olive oil with that. 1 tablespoonful of cornmeal.
A big tea cornmeal. Mm-hmm.
1 pound of red potatoes scrubbed and unpeeled.
A pound of red potatoes. Red potatoes are the best.
Yeah,
I think
they're the best.
A pound of red potatoes scrubbed, unpeeled.
1/2 pound of yellow onions. You could use red onions if you want to. Paired and sliced paper thin.
Mm-hmm.
A clove of garlic finely minced.
A clove of garlic finely minced.
Only fresh. Got to be fresh. Then you've got 1/2 teaspoon of fresh sage-leaved minced. And if you don't have sage, basil will work just fine. Mm-hmm.
Fresh sage leaves minced.
1/2 teaspoon of ground, freshly ground black pepper.
1/2 tea ground black pepper.
1/2 teaspoon of salt, kosher salt if you've got it.
1/2 tea salt.
Okay. So preheat the oven to 400 degrees, and actually you could preheat it to 500 degrees. Make your oven really, really hot. And if you've got a pizza stone, you heat it up for a half an hour before, it will make a crisper pizza. These are stones that you put in the oven, and so when the pizza goes on, it's hot. Roll out the pizza dough on a floured work surface to fit about a 12-inch round pizza pan. Spray the pan lightly, unless you're going to put it directly on the stone, and fit the pizza dough on the pan. Dust it with cornmeal before you put it on the pan. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dry the potatoes thoroughly. That's really important. Slice as thinly as possible into rounds. Place the potatoes and thinly sliced onions on the pizza. Put minced garlic and sage in a bowl and mix it together, and then toss it with a rubber spatula so it's mixing it well, and then spray the pizza dough lightly with the olive oil cooking spray because that'll make it crisper, and then layer the potato onion mixture on top, and don't forget to put, once again, this garlic sage mixture on top of that. It's wonderful because it's all sprinkled together.
Yeah, it's still hard for me to get my head around potato uh-huh. pizza.
Yeah. Well, that's because you haven't tasted it. I'm going to bring it in on the show one day for you. I promise you.
Couldn't I put some sausages
back
on
there? No, you can't. You can't. All right. It's a vegetarian pizza. Okay, you're going to bake it for about 10 minutes because mm-hmm. if you have it thin enough with a proper oven that's at about 500 degrees, 400 to 500 degrees, mm-hmm. you can really get it nice and crisp up in about 10 minutes. But if you're not that thin, if the potatoes are not that thin, then you're going to have to do it for about 15 to 20 minutes. You'll get it. Try it once. You'll figure out how it is. Take it out. Take out a little piece of potato, and if it seems like it's not thoroughly cooked, put it back in. Mm-hmm. Once you make this recipe, you will love it, because if you love potatoes, who doesn't love potatoes
in
America?
Yeah,
who doesn't like potatoes in America? This is a wonderful recipe. It's great.
Okay. Now, the year this was...
Okay, I have to guess.
Okay, here are the clues again. Okay. Pittsburgh Steelers beat the Arizona Cardinals.
Not a clue.
Super Bowl 43.
What's a Super Bowl?
Good.
Is it good?
This is the one that you might... there might be a good one for you. A Slumdog Millionaire wins the Oscar for Best Picture. Uh-huh. And Tiger Woods is, at least for a little while, leaving professional golf to focus on his marriage. What's the year?
2003.
No, way off.
Way off.
Yeah, too far, too long ago.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm supposed to guess again?
Yeah, you can.
1994.
No. I said it was too long ago that you guessed.
I'm just trying. Way to get one more guess.
I never would have guessed.
2006.
It. Yeah, close. 2009.
Definitely pretty
close. If there's a recipe you feel deserves an encore performance, let us know about it, and it might just end up being our next recipe from the vault. And don't worry, you don't need to know the original air date. Simply send the name of the recipe in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Now back to the phones, Zorba, a listener with us in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. I was so excited to finally have a question to ask you guys.
Oh, glad you called. How can we help?
Well, I've got a question about allergies. I have never in my life suffered from any seasonal allergy symptoms until this year. We had record high pollen levels in Oklahoma this year, and it was also my first spring to be living in a new home out in the country, and I'm also expecting my third child. So the combination of those three factors apparently was the perfect storm for me to get a really severe allergic reaction in my eyes that had me looking like Uncle Fester for over a month. It was pretty bad, really painful, and my optometrist said it was the worst case of allergic conjunctivitis he'd ever seen.
Oh, wow.
And steroid drops and mast cell stabilizing drops weren't even touching this thing. So I finally saw an allergist, mm-hmm. and we were able to do a few weeks of an oral steroid that mm-hmm. got things under control. But when he did allergy testing, it showed a really severe reaction to cedar pollen, mm-hmm. which I'm just surrounded by out here in the country. And so he recommended a sublingual immunotherapy mm-hmm. serum treatment. Mm-hmm. And he felt like that would be safe to start during pregnancy. But then since I've had several medical professionals caution me against that. So I was just curious on a couple levels. Number one, what's your thought on sublingual immunotherapy treatment and its effectiveness as a whole? And mm-hmm. then also, what are your thoughts on starting such a treatment during pregnancy or even while nursing if I do that after delivery?
So first of all, I don't start it during pregnancy. I wouldn't do that. Well, I couldn't do that. I can't get pregnant.
No, right.
But I wouldn't recommend doing that because you don't start anything during pregnancy that is elective, you know, in terms
right.
of a drug. When you're breastfeeding, I doubt if it'll be an issue. But now, sublingual therapy may work. You know, allergists have been trying it for years versus injections. We used to give a lot of injections in our office, but since the medications are better, injections are much less common than they used to be. And sublingual therapy is sort of kind of ho-hum. You know, it may work, it may not work. Allergists like it, but the evidence is sort of scattered. You know, scattered means it's not really bright. You can have a bad case of conjunctivitis, and it may not have been allergic conjunctivitis. You might have had a bad case of viral conjunctivitis, and we don't have a way of differentiating that. So you moved into a new house, could have had a virus. The drops didn't seem to get it to work. The steroid drops that you were on and something called mast cell drops work for a viral conjunctivitis and they work for an allergic conjunctivitis. But a viral conjunctivitis is much less likely to be responsive. So I question the diagnosis. In other words, you may not have had an allergic conjunctivitis. You may have had a viral conjunctivitis. Now, when they finally put you on steroids, steroids are a heavy-duty drug. They're going to work differently. But you had a time frame there. How long was it from the beginning of the eye problem to when you took the oral steroids?
Just over a month.
Well, the viral conjunctivitis might have gotten better coincidentally, or it might have been helped by the oral steroids. You know, there's no way of really knowing because we
right.
can't test for the viral conjunctivitis. So I question the diagnosis. That's number one. Number two, the issue is if you chronically put not a steroid, but an antihistamine eye drop in your eye every day, once or twice a day, or a mast cell stabilizer such as Patanol, these other prescription eye drops, you might keep this from happening during allergy season. In other words, you might have been playing catch-up, you know, because you waited a certain period of time, and it might be you go, hey, it's allergy season, I'm going to just put the drops in prophylactically. That might work for you, especially if it's a non-steroid eye drop, because the steroid eye drop, you don't want to do that because it has side effects. But the non-steroid ones are very, very safe. So I think if I were you, and once again, I can't be you because I'm not pregnant and I have four kids, I would not do the sublingual therapy now, and I would put eye drops in my eyes prophylactically at least once a day during the season, and I wouldn't move out of my house back to the city.
No plans to do that. So
so that's what I would do. And I would wait on the sublingual therapy, I would say.
Okay.
I have another question. Do you have to pay for the sublingual out of pocket, or would it be
yes.
covered by your insurance?
Well, and that was the other reason I was really doing my research, because they said it more than likely my insurance wouldn't cover it. I don't know the exact cost, but it's definitely, you know, several hundred dollars.
Maybe the exact cost might be very, very expensive. And the reason why insurance companies don't cover it is that it hasn't been scientifically proven to work.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to I kind of look at askance at that before I'm going to pay $300, $500, it might be several thousand dollars to get the treatment, because they may say, well, the treatment isn't working, we'll go to a higher dose or this, and it may be that when they're all done, the treatment doesn't work at all and you're out of that money.
Great. Well, thanks so much
You're
for
welcome.
Your advice. Appreciate
you're welcome.
It.
Thanks. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a listener question from Matt in Staunton, Virginia. He writes, "Hello, Zorba and Tom. Several dentists over the past few years have recommended that my teenagers have their wisdom teeth extracted. The dentist's referrals seem to be more a function of their age rather than anything specific in the x-rays that I can see. I am reluctant for them to undergo surgery for something that's totally non-symptomatic. Also, the clinicians most enthusiastic about the practice are also the ones who most often set my evidence-based medicine, spidey sense, tingling, in other matters. Where can I find good information for these questions? Exactly what percentage of untreated wisdom teeth will eventually become symptomatic? How accurate are orthodontists in predicting from adolescent imaging which teeth will cause problems later in life if they're not extracted? I like our current dentist, no tingling except from the mouth rinse, but he couldn't answer these questions.
Well, first of all, I don't have the numbers in front, so I can't. I've never done research on looking at the exact percentage. So,
okay.
What you have to do is go to the NIH website, which is PubMed.gov, and go in there and search for wisdom teeth, and you'll get some studies that are on there. I do have some of the answer as to what his question is, but that's the way you find it out.
Okay.
You do that research. The issue is dentists look at sort of the shape of the mouth and how the teeth are aligned to the mouth, and then they give you a clinical judgment as to whether or not they think the wisdom teeth, which are going to erupt in most people, not all of them, they're the final set of molars, are going to cause a problem, either by crowding the other teeth or with pain. And then they say, I think you should have them removed or not. You know, that's what they do. It's called clinical judgment. Now, I know that they're not right 100% of the time because there are people who have their wisdom teeth and they never erupt. They just stay behind there. So I know there's not there's predictability in there, but it's not 100%. I don't know if they're wrong 25%, 50%,
yeah,
or 75%. But I know there's a significant percentage of people where it never happens. And I think you sort of have to, you know, make an individual decision for your kids. Now, Tom, did you get your wisdom teeth removed?
Yeah.
And so did I. Yeah. Why?
Because they told me I should.
Yes. And you know what? They told me I should, too. Yeah. Now, my mouth is small. I needed orthodontia work and ultimately got it as an adult. Yeah. And the wisdom teeth, my dentist said, once they erupt, they're going to push the rest of your teeth all together. Yeah. Well, so I'm glad I had my
done. Extraction is so much better now than when I had mine taken out. Yeah, this is – I'm telling the truth. Mm-hmm. There were two dentists with a pliers-like thing pulling at the same time.
Pulling at the same time.
In tandem.
Yeah. Are you serious?
My roots hook. So
so there were two of them?
Two of them at the same time with that big device.
Oh, God. Was somebody holding you on the table at the same time? So you remember it. Was it loud?
Was it loud?
Yeah. Do you remember the sound?
I don't remember the sound at all.
Oh, you remember the pain?
Yes, I do. 800-462-7413, our number. Oh, and if you have a question you'd like Zorba to sink his teeth into, send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your questions, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk about anti-cholesterol drugs.
That's right. Good information on anti-cholesterol drugs. This is a study just published in the British Medical Journal on stroke. Now, if we look at the incidence of stroke, for instance, in people who are 85 years of age and older, so older adults, 43% of all deaths in that age group are from heart attacks, and 49% of those deaths are from stroke. So as you get older, it's a bigger and bigger issue. And we know, for instance, that high blood pressure drugs reduce stroke dramatically. What this study showed is that cholesterol-lowering drugs reduce stroke by 30% in this older age group. These were people over than 70 that were
30%
tested.
Is a lot.
Huge.
But don't
huge
we
amount.
Usually think of statins for lowering the stroke?
Well, we think of statins in lowering heart attacks. We've got very good data on statin-lowering heart attacks. And we've had reasonably good data, again, looking at statins and stroke. But what's interesting about this study is that we don't do a lot of studies with people 70 years of age and older that have 8,000 people. Nearly 8,000 were in this study, and they were followed for 10 years. So the number of people and the length of the study reinforces that statins also reduce the risk of stroke.
Yeah, now this wasn't a double-blind.
Oh, no. It was not a double-blind study. Half the people were on the statins. Half the people were not on the statins. So it's not, if you will, the gold standard. It's an observational study. But then again, it's one more thing to show that statins have great benefits. And these things are always coming up on websites. Don't take your statins. They're bad. They cause this loss. They cause that loss. But the reality is stroke is a really big issue. And this study shows that these drugs have good effect.
That's really promising news for those of us who take these.
Right. Now, so let's look at other things with stroke that are important.
Yeah.
Diet is important, making sure you're on a Mediterranean diet, getting your blood pressure under control, very, very important. Exercise, very, very important. And as you get older, it becomes even more important because stroke is disabling. You know, it's not just that it causes death. It's also a very disabling thing.
The study was done in...
Study was done in France, followed over a period of time. So the French are mostly on a Mediterranean-type diet.
Yeah.
And they actually they made sure that the different groups were totally controlled for whether or not they exercise, whether or not they overweight, whether or not they smoked, and so on. So it's not really that this is new data. It's that it reinforces good information.
You know, nobody is overweight in France.
That's right. They're all perfect. But I think it shows one more time, albeit that cholesterol-lowering drugs such as statins are not only good for preventing heart attacks, they're also good for preventing stroke. And I think that is the bottom line.
800-462-7413, our phone number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, back to the phones we go, welcoming a listener in Argenta, British Columbia. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, my question is about men and iron and cast iron cookware. I've noticed on men's vitamin mineral supplements, there's no iron whatsoever. And that's one of the main differences I see if you take a look at women's multivitamin mineral pills and men's. The men's have no iron, none whatsoever. And it seems to me I heard years ago there was some issue with men and getting too much iron. And it occurred to me that with cast iron cookware, which I know Zorba's a fan of, and
yep,
I like it too, if you cook something acidic in it, like a pineapple upside down cake or a tomato sauce, you might get a heck of a lot of iron. So my question is, why do men's vitamins have no iron, and is there an iron issue with men?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some very good...
Wait a minute. Let me get my... my mouth is watering from the thought of pineapple upside down.
Actually, I was thinking of the same. So, yeah,
let
so...
Let me get rid of that.
So
okay,
you cook
ahead.
Pineapple upside down cake?
Yes, sure.
I have never had pineapple upside down cake. I can't believe
it's traditionally done in a cast iron pan, and the pineapples are on the bottom.
You know what? I've got to talk. Our producer, Carl, we're going to have to dig up a pineapple upside down cake recipe.
Absolutely.
In cast iron cookware.
I can't believe it.
I will make it, bring it to the show, and Tom will sample it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so that's on our bucket list, right?
Okay, right.
Pineapple upside down cake. there's a good reason. First of all, women have iron in a traditional woman's vitamin because they lose iron when they menstruate. Because when they menstruate, they lose blood. Blood contains iron, and that's the issue. And a woman who's postmenopausal, if she's taking, we'll say, Centrum 50 Silver for women, it does not have iron. And one of the reasons is that when we do a blood test, if you're anemic, the first thing we think about as doctors is you might have a bleed somewhere, often in your gut, often in the colon, and it might be a sign of colon cancer. So in other words, a little bit of anemia is often worked up in our office to see whether or not something is going on. And then the other issue is there is such a thing as too much iron. Hemosiderosis, which is when you have too much iron, is not good. So men who eat a normal diet in America do not need iron. They get enough. Now, if you're a vegetarian or a more severe vegetarian, such as a vegan, and you don't get iron products, you might need an iron supplementation or a vitamin with iron. But that turns out to be a rare event in America. And if you're a meat eater, do you eat meat?
Yeah.
And you get plenty of iron. And that's where most of us get iron. Iron deficiency anemia, by the way, is the most common problem in the world. And there was that old remedy on TV, Geritol. Mm-hmm. Feel stronger fast. And basically, it was iron in an alcohol preparation. So you'd get a little bit woozy from the alcohol, and it was basically an iron product that does not exist anymore, to my knowledge. So how long have you been making pineapple upside-down cake? It's not the first thing I think about in a cast-iron pot.
Well, on and off for years, not very often. I have a good friend, and it's his absolute favorite thing. So for his birthday, I try to get one together.
Okay. Well, you know what? If you send us your recipe, I'll make it and we'll have it on the show. Is that a deal?
Okay.
I'm not sure we got to is, can you get too much iron?
The answer is yes. That's why we don't put iron in vitamins. You can't get it normally.
Using that cast iron.
No, you're not going to get too much iron. It's only a smattering of iron. It's really from iron tablets and iron and vitamins. It's not from the cast iron pot. So that means you can have pineapple upside down cake every single day for the rest of your life, and you won't have too much iron.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye.
800-462-7413. You will love pineapple upside down.
I know. Well, you know what? I'm going to make it. I hope he will send us the recipe, and then we will feature it on the on the website, and I promise I will make it, and we'll both eat. I've never had it.
800-462-7413, and myth-busting time again now, Zorba. Today's medical myth-buster comes to us from Marion, who's listening in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. She writes, "Dear Tom and Zorba, first off, I love your show. I'm overwhelmed with health news, and you make it accessible, fun, and offer direct but realistic advice. Thanks for what you do. My question, my sons are 12 and 15, and they're drinking up all of my soy milk. I love it and plan to only buy soy milk from now on. But since soy is recommended for menopausal women, does it give them extra estrogen?"
I don't think there's any evidence that it does. There are a lot of soy milk has become a very common alternative to cow's milk. I don't think there's any evidence that you get too much estrogen. There are some issues with soy in that if they have soy milk and they eat lots of tofu and then they have other sources of, other sorts of beans, you'll get something called phytoestrogens. And these are natural estrogen products, hormones that are actually produced by the plant. But you're not going to get too much through soy milk. If that were to happen, we would see boys already now who are suffering from that, and that's not the case. So it's a myth that you get too much.
Got it. Can you, by the way, say extra estrogen fast 3 times?
Extra estrogen, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. That was a trick question. That was not fair. We should take that off the show. Carl, you've got to remove that from the show.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or find us on Facebook.
Back to the phone, Zorba. A listener in Spokane, Washington with us. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Thank you for taking my call. I've been a fan for years.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm an 87-year-old woman. I've been running for over 40 years, and I'm wondering if you think that this is inadvisable for a woman of my age to run. Well, I do my 5,000 steps before breakfast every morning.
Wow.
And work out about an hour a day, total exercises, plus before dinner, tell Tom I do the inversion table before every meal.
Wow. How do you do 5,000 steps before? What do you do to get those five? Do you run around the block?
I run a couple of miles.
It's very interesting. You don't sound like you're 87. You do not sound like you're 87.
I also sing in the church choir. That helps.
That does help. That does help. But often,
you don't look like you're 87 either, by the way.
Thank you. I've been told that by many.
See, we have radio eyes. We can see on the other side of the radio. But there's an energy in your voice that is not...
I'm running, I think.
And I agree with that. That's what I mean. There's an energy in your voice. If you listen to people, as they get older, they often have a trill. They might have a tremor, just like we can get a tremor in any muscle. Mm-hmm. They have a tremor in their vocal cords. But a lot of it is due to a lack of energy or air that they have. And running and doing exercise that you're doing like that is excellent because it'll keep you robust. So let's look at the downside. The downside is, let's look from the injury downside. At 87, you are at a higher risk for injury than a 24-year-old because your recovery rate is not the same. No matter what happens, you're not going to recover the same. So do you run in a safe area when it's safe? Running in the middle of snow in the wintertime is...
Well, I did fall a couple of times on the ice this winter.
So that's the main risk. You've just hit the main risk. Falling, and if you fall and you fracture your hip, statistically, there's a 20% chance you will be dead in 2 years and a 50% chance you will have a severe disability in your activity of daily living. So one goal you should have in your health is not to fall. That's a major goal when you're 87, no matter what. So that means there's some times that you shouldn't run. That's what it means. So you might reduce your running by 10% or 20%, whatever it is. During the time that it's bad, you don't want to run. You want to do something else that's aerobic. That's the number one recommendation I have. People do not pay attention to athletic injuries that occur when they get older, and that is the chief cause of disability as they get older, period. And end of that. Now, number two, knees. How are your knees? How are your joints?
Since I did the 12K run a couple of weeks ago, behind my knees, not in the joint, but the whatever it is, tendon or muscle behind my knee has been bothering me a little bit.
Not enough. So, you know, stretching exercises that are good for that. If there's a significant pain, an anti-inflammatory massage therapy can often help that. But it's not a reason to stop running. In other words, if your knees are not swollen, but you've got some tendonitis there, I would just attach it like I would with any other tendonitis. On a scale,
I might point out that over 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with severe bone loss and osteoarthritis.
You bring up a great point. Here it is. 20 years ago, you're 87. You know, you've fallen and you don't have a fracture on there because you're exercising. And then how much calcium do you get with your food?
Food and supplement. Mm-hmm. I get plenty.
So that's it. Yeah. So 20 years ago, you must have made a decision that you were going to exercise and eat right.
Well, over 40 years ago, I did that.
40 years ago.
I was already running when my doctor called and told me that the results of my bone loss, and she said, I can't believe it because I thought you would be very good because you've been running so long.
Well, you would be worse if you hadn't been running. Most likely.
In fact, I asked her, I said, well, I've had lots of falls while running. You know, you trip on crack in the sidewalk or whatever, and you go down. But I've never had a broken bone. And she said, well, I think your muscles are holding your bones together.
Well, it's very interesting. The muscles don't hold the bones together, but if you're athletic and you run and you have balance, you're more likely to fall properly. That's probably it. So you probably roll with the fall because your muscles, you know, you're in your body, automatically you're going, oh, I'm falling. You're not holding out your hand to stop yourself, which is always bad because you can get a wrist fracture. So you're doing it the right way. But getting back to the injury thing, you're still going to fall when you're running, probably. But if you run in ice, you're more likely to fall and injure yourself. So that's about what I would look at. I would look at it from an injury reduction point of view, and I wouldn't stop doing what you're doing.
Okay. I might point out the two women who in that run, I finished first in my age category, by the way, in the 12K run.
Cool. Congratulations.
But the two women who were over 90 finished it faster than I did.
Oh, my goodness. How cool is that?
Yeah.
That is way cool. You are with a select group. That is absolutely wonderful. Well, keep it up. Keep it up.
You have a lot of runners in Spokane.
And you know what? It's great because you're a paradigm for good exercise. Congratulations. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. I'm tired. I'm going to take a nap after all that running talk. But before we head out, Zorba, time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Let's take an email from a listener, Rick, who has questions about your recent remarks regarding e-cigarettes. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I have a simple question. Do you think electronic cigarettes are safer than tobacco cigarettes? It seems that most healthcare professionals are against e-cigarettes because they have not been proven to be safe, and, in fact, they may contain some health risk. However, these same health professionals are often supportive of other harm reduction tools, such as clean needles and condoms. This is an issue that is very close to me. Both my father and grandfather died from COPD because they couldn't quit smoking. My wife tried to quit for at least 10 years using every quitting aid possible. Then she quit in one day after trying an e-cigarette. Both of my sisters and my brother-in-law quit soon after, also using e-cigarettes. Unless you can answer my question, no, I would suggest you clarify your position on harm reduction tools. Thank you for all you do in educating the public.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a very, very nice letter. I get more pushback on e-cigarettes than I do
from... We've gone
anything.
A little bit back and forth on that issue.
Well, let's put this into perspective.
Okay.
Number one,
yeah.
Tobacco is bad. We know that. We know that. We know, and it took many, many years, we know that tobacco causes lung cancer. It was not obvious at first because lung cancer is the most common killer that we have. It took a long time to figure that out. And it takes a long time to get lung cancer, 30 years.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to get COPD, 30 years. It takes a long time to get heart disease of this, 30 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the issue that I have with e-cigarettes is we know that e-cigarettes, that the best air to breathe is an air free of any toxin, anything.
Yeah.
We know that e-cigarettes have something in there because people take it and they can quit smoking. So we know there's something going on in terms of changing the habit. And because they're laced with nicotine, undoubtedly the nicotine is there. The issue is that we don't know if e-cigarettes are safe. That's the issue. Are they safer than cigarettes? Well, I would think on the whole, they're probably safer than cigarettes. On the other hand, I don't know. The problem is we won't know for 5 years or maybe 10 years or 15 years or 20 years what these e-cigarettes do. So we have a group of people that say, I quit smoking, I'm on e-cigarettes, I'm safe. That's the thought is. The thought is, I'm safer, I can do this now. It's a risk reduction tool. And the fact is, I don't know if it's a risk reduction tool at all. So I think it's a controversial topic. The real issue is that they should not be available to children under the age of 18 because we should treat them just like we do tobacco. Mm-hmm. And there should be a warning on the label that it should be a warning. We don't know what this is. There's nicotine in here. We don't know if it causes harm. And I think people should be allowed to buy them. I don't think they should be they should be disallowed by the FDA at all because I think they probably are less harmful than tobacco, but I don't know if they're less harmful than tobacco. And that's the bottom line.
If you disagree with something Zorba said, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org or find us through Facebook.
And of course, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0530Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.